we bring back our popular Philosophical Currents segment with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, a Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy and Director of the Institute for Philosophy in Public Life at the University of North Dakota. Today's topic is aging. I began our conversation by asking Dr. Weinstein to refresh us all on what he is hoping to accomplish with these monthly Philosophical Currents segments.
The goal with the segment is to just take the news and create a more philosophical spin on it. I really get frustrated with the adversarial nature of TV news and also the idea that everyone has to answer a question immediately. They have to know exactly what they're talking about at all times. They can't spend some time and figure it out. So what for me the goal is to explore these issues in a way that shows our thought processes, that lets people come into the discussion, and that takes a look at our world from, I don't know, a side door or something like that, in a way that people might not necessarily think about, but that will help them understand how these things connect with their lives.
We have many topics that we'll get to month after month, as you were able to discuss with Ashley Thornburg, my former colleague here at Prairie Public. So I am excited that we get to continue this segment. I think it's engaging, and I do think that it presents issues in a way maybe that people don't have time in today's compressed media or compressed news arena to maybe think about, in the context that we're going to allow them to maybe think about some different things. So kudos to us, Jack, for continuing on the torch here.
Pats on each of our backs.
There you go.
Backs, whatever the plural of backs are.
So today's topic, as we said in the promotion, is aging. And this is an important topic to me, Jack. As you know, just this last weekend, I attended my mother-in-law's memorial service. It was a wonderful time for our family, of course, but as she was going through the end of her life, it brought many issues to our minds again. Both of my parents have passed away, and I think it's an issue that many people have in the back of their minds, but maybe don't want to think about. And I'm curious, Jack, from your research, is it inherent in our human nature for us to be fearful of aging, or is this more of a construct, I guess, of modern society?
There are a lot of philosophers who believe that what makes human beings different from other animals is that we're aware of our own mortality, that we know our life is limited, and because of that, we have anxieties, we have neuroses, we have aspirations, we have all these other things. That the fact that our life will end is ever present in us. What there's less discussion about, however, is the process of getting to that end, the process of becoming older. And I see that in our society because we have a lot of discussion about the worth of older people, especially now with the Biden-Trump stuff. And we also have a lot of discussion of what it feels like to get older, but we don't connect them. These are two very separate conversations. So it feels like the people who aren't older are having a discussion about the use of older people, and the people who are older don't have the opportunity to explore what this new perspective is. They don't have anyone to talk with about it, and it becomes more frightening, more alienating, and it becomes harder to go through when, in fact, it's something everyone goes through, if they're lucky, and we should be talking about it all the time.
We should, and I don't think that children should be fearful of talking to their parents about this topic, Jack. And one thing that I noticed with my parents, my mother was much more adept in having a social structure as she aged to help her with issues that she was up against with her different diseases and different medical concerns and all of those sorts of things. And I thought that was very helpful for her. My father, maybe a typical male, didn't have as many social outlets in his, I guess, senior years, in his latter years, once he stopped work. And I think that was detrimental to his aging a little more gracefully, perhaps, than my mother did.
I think that that is a common experience. Certainly, many people who retire aren't prepared for it or lack that kind of meaning in their life, and they tend to flounder a little bit. At the same time, I think you're right that there's also gender stuff going on, because in our culture especially, men are not educated to express their emotions. They're supposed to be impregnable. They don't want to be vulnerable. And so when you do have men who are engaged in this conversation about aging, you get this sort of cliched moment of all the guys in the coffee shop at 8 o'clock in the morning, you know, where they have their own mug waiting for them and they sit there for an hour and a half, have a little food, talk about what ails them, talk about the just the gossip
or politics of the day. Sure.
Exactly right. And women do it much more integrated into their own lives. They take walks, they sit and have tea, they, you know, if they're of the right age, they text and talk on the phone and things like that. For men, these conversations are very, very compartmentalized. For women, they're much more integrated.
The other thing that always struck my mind is, does our country manage those who are aging better in certain parts of our country? In other words, the East Coast versus the West Coast, the North versus the South, the Midwest, or do other countries do better with maybe supporting and helping their aging parents or senior citizens in their community?
That's such a complicated question because, of course, through most of history, most people lived in multi-generational houses. And so the grandparents were around to help with the little kids, and the parents were around to help with the grandparents. And we in the United States really lost that for a variety of reasons. So I think that in smaller towns, in places where there is more structure for multi-generational interaction, that aging can be dealt with in a personal way and in a sort of family by family way. In the cities where there's much less space, where there's much more going on, we tend to take older people and put them in nursing homes. And then it becomes an institutional and a bureaucratic management. And some people thrive in nursing homes. My own grandmother had about 4 or 5 wonderful years in her nursing home. Other people, not so much. They feel alienated. They lose their family. And so in this instance, actually, I think it's about space and generational cultures in around the world. In Italy, you have multi-generational households. In Greece, you have multi-generational households. In Korea, you have multi-generational households, although often that is a response to high cost of living. And that if the whole family is in one apartment, it certainly is cheaper than if everyone is in their own place.
Fiscal necessity there.
Absolutely. And so much of our lives are driven by necessity, by the money we have to spend, the nature of our health, the nature of our abilities, right? If you have my father-in-law who passed away a couple years ago, he was an incredible carpenter. And when we bought our first house, he came up, he spent a few weeks here. He and I did a whole bunch of renovations on the house. When he got to the age where he couldn't handle a hammer anymore because he was shaking or he just didn't have the attention span or the visual acuity anymore, he began to feel useless. And the moment he started feeling useless, he became angry and defensive, and you can imagine what happens next.
Sure.
So much of our necessity connects to our abilities and what we can and can't do. And for older folks, and I actually think for almost all adults, you define yourself by your abilities so much that when you start to lose those abilities, you really feel like you're losing a piece of yourself.
Do we know much about how different societies are managing in this high-tech world aging and assisting those who are getting older?
I don't know that there has been a kind of science fiction shift where the technology is taking care of the people, where there's such advanced artificial intelligence that the technology or the computers or what have you are making profound changes in the social experience of folks. However, medical technology, the ability to do operations from remotely, the ability to have conversations with your grandkids or your grandparents over FaceTime, these things have profoundly changed society because I know that with my parents and I'll say my daughter, with all of her grandparents, my daughter is texting with them all the time, is sending pictures with them all the time. And so we aren't at the science fiction sort of fantasy level yet where nursing robots, you know, care for people 24 hours a day. But we are at a place where the expansion of technological ability, the speed of things, the connected things, does change what resources we have to help make everyone's lives, but particularly the older folks' lives, better.
Jack Russell Weinstein, he's a Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy and the Director of the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life at the University of North Dakota, joins us here on Main Street. We're continuing our philosophical current segments. Today we're talking about aging. Jack, with what's happened with President Biden, and of course with millions of Americans who are older, what is the role of memory in shaping our perception of aging?
That is a wonderful question. It's a really rich and interesting question because, of course, most of what we experience is in our imagination. The past is in our imagination. The future is in our imagination. By the time I finish this sentence will be in your imagination. The only thing that we exist in is the now. Part of the way that human beings deal with that is that we are narrative animals. We are animals that tell stories to make meaning, whether they're religious stories to give us symbolism and things like that, or whether just the story of who is Jack, who is Craig, how did they get to this point? When you start to lose those connections, you lose the ability to really argue for who you are. You lose the ability to articulate your ideas. And very often with folks who are struggling with Alzheimer's or other memory issues, they remember the long distant past, mm-hmm. but they don't remember the recent past. And so then they start imagining that they're talking to people who have passed away 3-4 years ago, or they sometimes think that they're still a child or they're living with their mother or father or something like that. And because the imagination plays such an important role in our lives and our experiences, and because narrative plays such an important role in the meaning of our lives, the moment you start losing your memory, you start to lose the core features that make human beings, including rationality, analogy, and just the ability to empathize and connect with other people. One of the shifts in medical care, as I understand it, and we are way beyond my expertise here, is the advice that people now give for older folks who are having memory issues is to play along with them, is to the person's in a hospital bed and says, you know, I just saw Uncle Jack yesterday. He won $2,500 in the lotto. You're supposed to say, oh, really? Oh, how lucky for him, even though it's not true. Affirming people's experience allows them to be happier, allows them to have less anxiety. Recognizing that we can affirm people's experiences, even if they're not accurate or true, is a revolution in how we deal with older folks.
Jack, what ethical responsibilities does society have towards our aging populations, especially since we are living longer? There are more of us in that category of senior citizen or older. What is society's responsibility? We hear talk about Medicare, we hear talk about Social Security, but not much more about the care and the social aspects of living a long, long life.
That too is a rich and complicated question because, of course, someone who's a libertarian who believes that we don't have any other responsibility towards other people is going to have a very different attitude than someone who believes that we have to act always as a community watching out for each other. The fact of the matter is, and I tell my students this all the time, if you look at the great Western tradition, the very first question that humanity asks is, am I my brother's keeper? Mm-hmm. Cain asks that of God in defense of his own actions, but it is the question that threads through all human conversation from that point forward. Am I my brother's keeper? What responsibility do I have towards my neighbors? What responsibilities do I have towards my family members? What responsibilities do I have towards my to strangers? And then, really hard, what responsibility do I have to the foreigner, the person outside my community, the person who might be living under a different code of ethics or a different way of seeing the world? The thing about taking care of older folks is that it really depends on our fundamental sense of what it means to be a community. Are we a bunch of people who happen to live together and just going about our business, but we're on the same train, we're crossing the same street, et cetera? Or are we people who build each other's lives? You know, I am incredibly indebted to the previous generations that built my house, that built the road, that put the stop sign on the corner. I mean, I'm dedicated. I'm very fortunate to have several generations who have created Prairie Public and who have built North Dakota and the University of North Dakota. I could not be who I am, and I cannot live the life that I have without the assistance of hundreds of millions of people in the past. And so you have to ask yourself, do we have a reciprocal obligation? Because the past gave us gifts, do we have to return that gift, to take care of the people who are the past, and also to take care of people in the future? I myself feel that that is a very important responsibility, and I think it's a responsibility of the government, but also of communities and non-governmental organizations and families and things like that. But your mileage may differ. People are going to have very different attitudes about that depending on how they see themselves politically, how they see themselves morally, and it always boils down to this question. Am I my brother's keeper? Because the next question of that is, who is my brother? Right? You have to know who your brother is to know if you're your brother's keeper. And the thing that is most common to say is that my sister is my brother too, right? Brother is non-gendered. Brother applies to everybody. And that in itself is a profound revolution. And so this is not a question that I can answer. It is a question, however, that I can point out is connected to almost everything else we do.
Jack, one of the reasons I'm so excited to continue these philosophical current discussions with you is to understand more about philosophy, where I don't believe I've given much time in my life to really engage with. But I do want to ask you about the intersection here of religion and philosophical beliefs or ideas relative to aging and the afterlife and how it impacts people who are aging.
I have seen in my own experiences, people who were strict secularists get older and start to believe in God. Maybe they aren't accepting of a traditional religion, or maybe they don't necessarily know what God looks like, but there's just this sense that there is something out there, and there's a sense that there's something next. There are people who are perfectly comfortable with the idea of the cessation of our existence, who say, I'm going to die, I'm not going to feel anything, I'm not going to experience anything, so I'm not going to worry about it. But there are other people for whom that mortality or the memory of friends is so powerful that they need a story, that they need a narrative, that they need someone to tell us there's more happening. This is just the next chapter. Religion provides that. And I don't mean to say that religion is a fiction. That's for people to decide for themselves. But what I mean is that religion is much more than a particular story. It's the symbolism. It's the rituals. It's all of those other things. And so one of the ways that many people deal with their impending mortality is by planning for their death, is telling people what they want said at their funeral, at picking a gravestone or deciding that they're going to be cremated or something like that. Religion connects to all of these things because it gives meaning to what could just be shallow actions. So, for example, there's often controversy because in the Jewish tradition, it's very important to be buried in a Jewish cemetery. There are people who believe that people with tattoos can't be buried, or that non-Jewish spouses can't be buried in there. And it becomes such a profound symbol of their lives that it creates conflict. And of course, synagogues and all religions adjust over time. So I think religion provides a bunch of different things. I think first, it provides the story for people who need it. Second, I think it provides the meaning of their daily lives that help them make choices. And then it just provides psychological comfort for them and for the people who know them, because they feel like someone loves them, someone's watched over them. You have a whole another 500 lives to reach nirvana. Whatever it is that is relevant to your experience, religion helps create meaning and ritual in our lives. And that's infinitely more important than, do you believe in God, or what things does your God approve or disapprove of? It's the meaning and it's the ritual that connects these great traditions to our lives.
Jack, as we wind up our conversation today, one of the things I've noticed with my family is that physical decline was associated then with intellectual and mental decline. And I wasn't certain it should have been that way. What have you noticed, or what is out there relative to continued intellectual and spiritual growth, even though your body physically isn't doing so well?
This too is very difficult. There are great philosophical questions about the relationship between the mind and the body that if we had more time, we could get into. But part of what happens is that when your body starts to betray you, and that happens at much earlier age than we like to admit, when our bodies start to betray us, we have less opportunity to go to the theater, to be social with other people. We have to be cared for, and often the caregivers treat us like we're babies, because since we can't walk, or if we have a hard time hearing, then that means something cognitive is going wrong. And the danger is that by treating people as if they have lower cognitive functions, you realize those lower cognitive functions. You don't expect the same kind of conversation or reading or adventure or those sorts of things. So one of the things that technology is very, very good at is creating stimulation for people who might not be as mobile as they used to be. There's a joke that goes around the internet a bunch, and my best friend and I talk about it. We're Generation X, and that once the nursing homes are full of Generation X, everyone is going to be playing video games and smoking pot. And that the vision of what a nursing home life in is completely different, because our generation is the first generation raised on computers as a lifestyle device, computers as an entertainment device. And there's no reason to think that if you spent the first 50 years or 60 years of your life playing Mario Kart, you're not going to want to do it when you're 85 or 90. And if we can figure out a way to integrate intellectual exercise, the strengthening of the brain muscle in what we're doing, that is an incredibly liberating experience, which is why, in fact, if you know musicians, for many, especially professional musicians, the ability to play their instrument is the last thing to go. They may have terrible arthritis, but if they can move their fingers, they can play the piano or what have you. And that just goes to show you that the mind is trapped by the body, and what we need to do is make sure the mind gets exercise on its own.
And be cognizant of those that we are with, that in fact the mind can get that exercise, even though there are physical limitations perhaps.
Absolutely right.
Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein from the University of North Dakota, he joins us for Philosophical Currents. Jack, it's a pleasure.
It's my pleasure as well, Craig. Thank you.